What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
With us on America Trends is Jessie Strybe. She is a professor, a sociologist at Duke University, and it is a fascinating book that she has written. She has come upon something that I don't think many of us really can even imagine. In the book, The Accidental Equalizer, and then the subtitle of the book is How Luck Determines Pay After College. Now, I know you said that there are a lot of folks who scratch their head when they hear about the findings, when they realize that something as surprising as what you have unearthed comes about and comes into the public's consciousness. So why don't you tell us how startling you feel the information that you have is for most people?
And I don't think I would have believed it before collecting all the data and doing all the work to find the answers. And I think the reason it's so startling is that what I'm finding is that luck not only matters in what college graduates get paid, but it matters so much that it erases the effect of class background on people's earnings. That is, so once you graduate from the same college, your class background no longer predicts your earnings. So kids who grew up poor and kids who grew up rich who go to the same college end up earning about the same amount on average. And I think that is startling because everything we know about what it takes to get a high-paying job would suggest that people from higher class backgrounds are going to get those higher-paying jobs. So we know they complete more internships. They have more connections to professionals. They have slightly higher GPAs. They have more status symbols. And all of those things you would think would lead to these high-paying jobs. And so the fact that they don't and that something like luck can overcome that, I think really is kind of hard to wrap your head around.
Yeah, well, first of all, you also expand on that to say that there's another sociologist by the name of Michael Hout who concluded that college graduation cancels the effects of background status, period. Not just the same college, but any university four-year degree has that effect. And that seems like something of an overreach, but maybe it's true.
It appears to probably be true. There are some debates about whether or not this is an effect of a small sample size, but a lot of studies have found that once you go to college, your class background no longer determines your earnings, which I think is really hard to believe. Even if that part is potentially a little bit exaggerated, we do know for sure that if you go to the same college, your class background no longer affects your earnings, which in of itself is, I think, still a huge accomplishment and a surprise, I think, because all of these inequalities exist within the same college too, these differences in internship rates and money you have access to and connections, all of these things we would think would really matter are not determining people's pay after college.
Now, are we talking about state schools? Are we talking about mid-level schools? I mean, Duke University, where you teach, is a very prestigious school. I live right down the road or up the road, no, down the road from Yale. Then there's Harvard. I mean, we hear about all the special treatment. We hear about legacy admissions. So does this apply to all types of colleges?
So the fact that your class background no longer predicts your earnings does seem to apply to all different types of colleges. But the mechanism that I'm going to talk about how that happens, is only going to apply to not as elite colleges. So selective colleges, less selective colleges, but not the ones that you would hear about in the newspapers all the time. So that is a different type of labor market. And I think your question, though, also raises a good point, is that there's so much inequality by class background in getting into those colleges. So we're talking about equal pay for the students who graduate from college, which is a select group of students. And so many kids who grow up in disadvantaged classes don't have the opportunity to graduate from college.
Now, you talked to a lot of folks in terms of this research, and you looked at a lot of information. I believe it was generally focused on business majors, mm-hmm. correct?
Correct. So business majors are, they're the biggest group of college-educated people. They're about a quarter of the college-educated labor force. They're also the group least likely to go to graduate school, and so their earnings right out of the gate really matter. And they're the group with the most earnings variation. So they're a group you would really think, oh, those students from more advantaged class backgrounds, they've got these opportunities to out-earn students from less advantaged backgrounds compared to something, say, like teaching, where people are making pretty similar amounts. So I think business is this nice case study to look at, well, how does it when there's so much opportunity for some students to out-earn others that your class background still doesn't matter?
Is this perhaps something that happens out of the gate because they look at a lot of factors? And as you say, a lot of folks who go into these interview situations who have advantages, who may have had a father or an uncle who worked at, name a big business company or a McKinsey and company or someone, and they felt they had an inside track, or at least they understood better what might be confronting them in the interview. And you find out that, in fact, they were blindsided. They didn't know really what this person was going to ask, and they had no greater advantage or inside track than anyone else. I guess the question is about the length that this lack of inequality, this luck as you call it, and I want to talk to you about that after, but you know, how long that lasts in a career?
I think pretty long. So we know that at least about 20 years out of graduating college, so in people's 40s, their class background is still not related to their earnings for college graduates. So it seems to last quite a long time.
Now, why do we call it luckocracy? By the way, it really rolls off the tongue. I like it. Luckocracy. It didn't roll off my tongue that time. But why would you, why call it that? Why not just say meritocracy?
Well, because I don't think merit is what's getting people high pay. I think it is luck. So let me tell you a little bit about why.
Sure.
I think that's true. When you are looking for a job as a business major at a non-elite college, you are confronted with potentially hundreds of different job options. So you're going to narrow it down and say, I want to be in this business subfield or that business subfield. But even within that, you have a lot of options. You know, most businesses have somebody in finance and somebody in HR and somebody in marketing. So there's a great job market to enter. But that also means it's really hard to get information about any particular job. Wages are usually not posted in job ads, or if they are, the range that they give you is so big that it's hard to make sense of what it means. You don't have a lot of information either about what they're looking for in applicants. So how are they hiring? What are they looking for in a resume? What are they going to ask you in an interview? How are they evaluating your answers? You have very little idea. And so you're having to guess all the time, where are those high-paying jobs among the type of jobs I want? And how do I get them? And because everybody has to guess, luck is going to play this major role. And then the other part of it is that the employers in this kind of mid-tier business labor market, they're not evaluating students on things that are related to their class background. And so everybody's going to have to guess, but their guesses are going to be equally likely to pay off no matter what class they're from.
Now, everyone who you talk to who has money and some opportunity to send their children to advanced classes starting at age 2, mm-hmm. To get them into every sports activity, every other extracurricular, you know, association that they know, they do that. And they think that that is really giving someone all the natural advantages that you want to give your child. And yet it seems as if some of those things perhaps do not end up being the factors that impress someone, because they've obviously, by the time you get in for the interview, they've read the resume. They know what's on there. They know all the things that you have done. Maybe you're the rugby champion of Greenwich, Connecticut. I live in Connecticut. So Greenwich is a symbol of this type of thing. Does that not affect anyone? Or is it better communication skills? Is it just somebody who's got a nice smile? I mean, do those things help? Is there anything other than luck and having a four-year degree that's somewhat related? Is there any advantage that is known that certainly plays a role in all of this?
Well, those things are hugely helpful in getting into and potentially even graduating from college. So they really, really matter for people's life chances. But once you are graduating and you're competing with other people who are graduating too, in this mid-tier business sector, they don't actually care that much if you played golf versus rugby versus basketball, you know, so the kind of more elite sports versus the less elite sports. If you are a classical violinist, you know, this kind of high cultural capital, kind of more, you know, it's a leisure activity associated with the upper middle class, they also don't care, right? Because what's that going to do for them in the business world? So they might like that you have a passion, that you work hard, that you've shown dedication in your practice and your discipline. But there's a lot of ways to show those things that don't have to do with these more elite things. You can show that by going to work at McDonald's every day and that you are a really disciplined worker. And so they're pretty open to thinking about what they want. And maybe that is like a great work ethic or great leadership abilities or great communication styles. But those don't necessarily have to come from something that's associated with having a lot of money to do. Like you can be great at communicating without having a diction class or
you could be a disc jockey on the college radio station and acquire some skills. What about curling? I mean, if you were great at curling, that had to do it. Now, well, we're talking to Jesse Strive, and she is a sociology professor at Duke University and the author of The Accidental Equalizer, How Luck Determines Pay After College. So let's back up a little bit. The importance of getting into college and to having a four-year degree. Now, you reference in what I've read that decredentializing is something that is starting to occur in America, where the four-year degree is not seen as the be-all and end-all. We did a podcast on this with a group called Opportunity at Work, and I think it's a fascinating development that many state governments, for example, are looking at equivalent experience in the military, or however you might have acquired it. Maybe you went to a two-year certificate program, and they are looking at that as being equal in value to somebody who gets a four-year degree, particularly as it relates to coding, as it relates to more of the technical skills in the computer age. But that will have a more leveling effect, a more equalizing effect going forward, perhaps, than even what we're talking about here.
Oh, I completely agree. And I think it would be a great step to have more businesses look at people without four-year degrees. So when I talk to employers, and these are people who are hiring people often only with four-year degrees, they often said things like, we're hiring on the skills we hope your mom taught you, which means they're hiring on things like social skills, soft skills. How well you communicate? Are you pleasant to be around? Can you work in a team? They are pretty explicit. We're not hiring on anything you learned in college in your classes. And if that's the case, it does seem like we could be hiring a lot more people who didn't have a four-year degree. So many people don't have the money to go to college, but they do have those soft skills. And so being able to hire them would do a lot more to level the playing field too.
I'm surprised sometimes when I read that about 65% of the people in the country have not attained a four-year degree. I'm wondering how that looks, and I'm not certain that you've studied this and if I'm outside of the bounds of your comfort level, but this whole issue between the legacy admissions that I referenced earlier balanced against the recent Supreme Court ruling saying that affirmative action itself is not something that is encouraged, yet schools are trying to find ways around that to make certain that kids who don't have a lot of background but have a lot of ability ultimately can, you know, be found even if they didn't have all the advantages in their youth in terms of what wealthier parents can provide. So where do you think that might take us in all of this?
It's a great question. It's hard to predict the future, and I don't have any inside information on how college admissions officers are thinking about this. I mean, you can imagine a world where they take class more seriously and think more about how can we have a class-diverse student body, especially at the elite universities. I mean, they might call it class diversity, but it's not a lot of class diversity. So at a place like Duke, I think we've got 4% of our students are from the bottom 25% of the income distribution, and 19% are from the top 1%. So very top-heavy. So maybe we'll have more class diversity, but also requires more money. So maybe not. But I don't know is kind of the short answer. I'm also kind of watching and very curious about how colleges are going to handle this.
Well, I think it's fascinating if you dovetail with your findings that if somebody gets in and is motivated, that they come out with a lot of the same advantages or luck, if you will, on their side, if they are fortunate enough to find the right interviewer in the right circumstance. And I guess that's another question, which is this whole interviewing process that people are going through, where in fact many of those other issues wash away and you get to the essence of what they are looking for. And it is luck, because nobody really knows walking into one of those situations. And I remember from way back when, not anything recently, how nerve-wracking that is and how uncertain you are as to whether you are meeting expectations, even when you've walked out of the room. So is there anything about the interviewing process that is unique that anybody can try to improve their luck with, if you will?
I think that's a great point, and because it reminds us too that colleges themselves don't have to be the great equalizer. They can actually, if they admit students, even though they can't equalize a lot of things about their lives, you know, their money, their connections, potentially even their internship opportunities, it doesn't matter if the labor market is the factor that's doing the equalizing. And one of the ways that they're doing it is providing students with so little information about what the interview process is going to be like. So you go in, as you say, you don't know what you're going to be asked, and you don't know how you're going to be evaluated, which makes it really hard to prepare in advance. So if you knew ahead of time, then students with more connections, with more money, could figure out how to prepare better for those interviews. But because nobody knows, everybody is guessing. Students' connections are also not as helpful as you would think in these circumstances. Students from more advantaged class backgrounds often ask their parents or their family friends or their relatives, like, how do I prepare for this interview? But their parents and family friends and relatives are also just guessing. Like, they don't know what a stranger is going to ask their kid, and they don't know how their kid will be evaluated. And so they often sound very confident, like, oh, you need to prepare for this question and this question, and this is how you should answer. But usually those questions are never asked. And so it's not giving the kids advantages. Sometimes I think they're even a little bit disadvantaged because they have so prepared for a certain set of questions and then are really thrown off when they're asked a totally different set of questions. And then the other thing that happens is it's not only that they don't know how they'll be evaluated, it's that different interviewers are using different evaluation criteria, and some of them are completely contradictory. And so you have no idea if the person in front of you is evaluating you in one way or another, so you just have to guess. And so, for example, like, you might know that a company is looking for somebody with good communication skills because that's in their job ad. But what does that mean? So to some interviewers, that means being concise, and to others, it means being long and detailed. To some, it means showing you're decisive. To others, it means really pausing and reflecting. And you can't do both of those at one time, and so you do just have to kind of guess what they're looking for and then do that, or to be yourself and hope it works out. And so because it's so hard to know how you're being evaluated, and people have legitimate reasons for using opposite criteria, everybody's in this position of having to guess, which means luck really matters, and people's class background doesn't matter so much.
Well, when we talk about asking your uncle or your father, what would you do? And, of course, they haven't had to interview like that perhaps in 20 or 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
I would think the whole process has changed so much. I wouldn't even know how to look for a job today because most of it is online. I don't know whether you then go online and, you know, reach out to a social network and say, hey, I'm going in for a job interview at XYZ company. Has anybody done this recently? What are they like? Do they make you comfortable, uncomfortable? Are the questions hard? I mean, how do kids do it today?
Yeah, I mean, they apply online often, or they post their resume online on their university's website and somebody gets in touch with them. Or at business schools, there's a lot of networking opportunities and career fairs where they meet potential employers. But you're right that parents' advice is often pretty outdated. So they haven't been an entry-level worker in 20 or 30 years. They also sometimes aren't in the same industry as their kids. So, you know, your parents might be doctors who make quite a bit of money. But if you're looking for a job in HR or marketing or finance, they don't necessarily know anything about that world. And then the other thing is they also don't know what jobs pay well for that type of job that you want. And so, you know, maybe they have a friend who, let's say, is an HR generalist and can help you get a job as their kid. Well, does the friend's job, does their position, does it pay really well for HR positions or really poorly? They have no idea. And so they're just as likely to usher students from more advantaged class backgrounds who are using these networks more into these low-paying jobs as they are into high-paying jobs, because nobody knows how much one HR job pays compared to another. And there's often a big gap. It's just that the parents or the parents' friends are now guessing instead of the kid themselves.
I'm also wondering about who does the interview. I know I will recall, and I can still recall it now, about 35, 40 years later, that I went into one interview for the president of a small television station, and I had the entire board interviewing me. This was ludicrous. I had never been in a situation where your head is bobbing around, you're going from one person to the next. There was never an organized, rational approach to the interview because somebody had one concern. Do you fundraise? Do you do this? Can you do this? Sales? Whatever. It was just mind-boggling. I came out of there knowing that I didn't perform well because I didn't feel comfortable in the entire setting. How much does it differ if you are talking to a human resources person versus an expert in an area within the company that they think they're going to move you into or the job requires?
Yeah, I mean, it can be really different, especially with what kind of questions they're asking you. But either way, you don't know what they're looking for. So if you're talking to the HR person, maybe they are looking for teamwork and leadership and communication skills, kind of some basic things. And maybe the person in your role is looking for more technical skills that they could test on that the HR person couldn't. But you still don't know, well, which technical skills are they going to ask you about? Or how are they going to evaluate you? So I had one student who was asked some math questions, and he didn't know the answer. And so he asked the interviewer, well, how do you get the answer? I can't figure it out. And she told him the right answer was asking for help. Like, they didn't even care about his math ability. They were actually just testing. Like, you ask for help and you don't know the answer. And so, you know, he totally didn't do that on purpose. He would have loved to know the answer. But, you know, so it was completely unpredictable to him, and I think to most people, what that evaluation criteria would be. And so you're still just guessing no matter who's interviewing you and hoping for the best.
Yeah, as we look at this, the outplacement officers at colleges, what role do they play in any of this? In other words, if somebody from a mid-level school, and here in the state of Connecticut, we've got some great schools, and we've got a lot of good mid-level schools. But say those from the mid-level school, you really wonder coming in, gee, I wonder if their education is as good as the one that I saw somebody recently from Yale, and whether this school really matches up. How important is the role of the outplacement office in trying to make certain that they are setting any individual, whether they come from an advantaged or disadvantaged background, up to do well in that setting?
Yeah, I mean, I think they do a lot. So they kind of bring up the bar of students' knowledge from all class backgrounds. So they work with students about what a good resume looks like, what types of answers could be good for interview questions in a kind of general way rather than a specific knowledge way. you know, but things like you should be positive when you're answering, you should smile, you should make eye contact. They tell students a lot about what to wear. So they provide a lot of baseline knowledge that I think is really helpful. But because students from all class backgrounds are getting that knowledge, it's potentially also leveling the playing field in some ways, although all of that information is also available online. So if you didn't have a career services office, if you did a quick Google search, you could find it very quickly.
Did you find anyone who worried about cues that they might give off if somebody really began to plumb their background and they ended up blurting out that they lived, in a ramshackle situation for a period of time? There was no indoor plumbing. I'm getting a little outsized here. But what I'm saying is the cues that they might give that might not be something that somebody who is an intake officer at a company wants to hear. Is there any worry about that, even if they have good credentials, that maybe somebody says, well, maybe they just won't fit into our culture overall?
I didn't hear a lot about that, but I don't think the students tend to volunteer that much information. The way that their class background might come out is that they worked through college, which employers tend to like. You know, it shows a lot of dedication. The types of places they work, I think they worked at potentially like McDonald's or a fast food place where somebody else was working at a country club, something like that, it could come out. They might say that they're a first-generation college student. There is some evidence from audit studies that saying that is not a good idea, that employers do discriminate based on that. But I don't think that many students tell people that mm-hmm. that is their background. And so it's coming out in more indirect ways, subtle ways, and I think it's just often not the main point of the interview, not something that's that obvious. Kind of also surprising to me, the employers I talk to are mostly ignoring the signs of more elite status too, right? They're ignoring the golf, the international travel, or if they care about international travel or study abroad, it might just be because it signals language ability, in which case, if you're a kid of an immigrant, for example, you might have the same language ability. You just got it through a different means. And so they're mostly using criteria that are very class neutral.
I guess I've seen Legally Blonde too many times. Let me ask you about where we're headed, because you talked about it earlier, that maybe because we are in a labor-constrained market now, and lots of people are probably getting jobs that would have been a little more difficult in the past were there not such pressures to hire people in this moment. And I know that from the intake standpoint, getting into college, not getting the job, we're at an interesting inflection point because, number one, the costs are really driving a lot of people away. I'm talking not only mm-hmm. about the disadvantaged, but the middle class. Mm-hmm. Then you've got a situation where, in fact, we have a demographic shift. So we have fewer kids coming through. So I think a lot of the mid-level colleges are under great pressure, and that's mm-hmm. why they're offering certificates and other things to bring in a different type of student, because a four-year liberal arts student may not be there for them going forward. Then I'm also reading, I know I'm adding a lot to this mix, mm-hmm. but that the SATs and the ACTs, which were taken away in certain schools during the pandemic, mm-hmm. and some saying, oh, that's not a good tool. And yet now they're looking at that again saying, no, that is actually a pretty good leveling tool because we don't know the quality of the high school that they came from. This is a better judge of their capabilities. So when you add all of that together, the demographic shifts, the tight labor market, and even reintroducing, in some cases, a standardized test, how might this look going forward, the pressure to either get into a school or for schools just to say, well, we're going to take someone because we need another tuition, and therefore maybe the quality of either the over-advantage or the under-advantaged kid is not what it is today?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's going to depend a lot on what type of university you're talking about. So the elite universities aren't going to have any trouble attracting a lot of students. So mm-hmm. the mid-tier ones might, but I think that like SAT and ACT scores are less important to them. It's easier to get into those schools anyways. Yeah, I mean, I think we might see some colleges closing and we might see some changes in the student body. But because the employers I talk to in this mid-tier business labor market are pretty open that they're not hiring on skills you learn in college, except for like extracurriculars. They think that you learn soft skills through your extracurricular activities at college, which I'm not sure is true. I don't think we have evidence either way. I am not that worried that if we have students who are from who have slightly less kind of educational rigor in their background, that if they go to college at higher rates, that we will not see an equalizing effect anymore, or that it will matter tremendously for certain types of jobs. I think at a lot of jobs, we are now hiring people with college degrees when they could have done them with high school degrees. It doesn't worry me that these changes are coming.
Interesting. What about the labor market issues of the day? How much did that play into the research as you see it?
Yeah, I don't think we would see as much equalizing in a recession. So when it's really hard to get a job, networks really matter, and students from more advantaged class backgrounds have better networks. We have a really low unemployment rate for college graduates now, and so getting a job isn't the thing that causes inequality. Instead, we see a lot of pay differences, and that's the thing to care about. And because networks don't have information, people you know don't have information about what jobs pay well, often, especially in this mid-tier labor market where companies are not advertising that they're such high payers, then the networks don't matter as much. And so if we saw a recession, though, networks are going to be the big difference in who gets a job, and then we would see potentially less equalizing.
Let me ask you in closing, looking at all that you've studied, the people you've talked to, and the findings, which are surprising, and again, we go back over them, the fact that if you graduate from the same college, you often go on to earn the same amount of money regardless of whether you started out with one hand tied behind your back because of disadvantaged circumstances versus advantage, and we can all define that in various ways. What do you think is the most important takeaway from all of this?
I think that luck is really what determines a lot of people's pay, and that's because everybody's guessing about where to apply, where those high-paying jobs are for the type of job you want, and how to get them, how you're going to be evaluated, and that a lot of employers are doing a really nice job of using class-neutral criteria. So everybody's guessing, but everybody's guess is equally likely to pay off no matter what class background you're from.
All right. Professor Jesse Strieb, the accidental equalizer, how luck determines pay after college. Well, I've been lucky, you've been lucky, and I hope the person who's listening, who's gleaned something from this, gets lucky in their job search. I thank you so very much for being with us today here on America Trends.
Thanks for having me.